content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, commuting is bad, particularly for women. A growing body of research shows how longer travel times affects moms' ability to work. This was written by Stephanie H. Murray. For all of the professional gains women have made over the past several decades, one stubborn measure of inequality, the gender wage gap, has been especially difficult to stamp out. And it's a disparity that can be traced in large part to parenthood. In nearly every country on Earth, the arrival of children tends to coincide with a lasting drop in employment and earnings for moms, but not dads. Conversations about how to better support working mothers typically focus on family policy, such as subsidized childcare and paid parental leave. But one significant factor affecting moms' employment remains under discussed: the commute. This is admittedly not a terribly sexy topic, but a growing body of research suggests that whether a mom can hang on to her job comes down to how long it takes her to get there. Notably, the crucial role that travel time plays in shaping maternal employment has been identified not only in the United States, but also in countries with far more robust family policies and social safety nets. Commutes also affect women up and down the socioeconomic scale, though in different ways. The negative influence of the commute is so pronounced that it's hard to imagine making the economy work for moms without acknowledging its impact. And the solution to the commute penalty may be as daunting as it is simple. To help moms work outside the home, society needs to make it easier for them to work near home. The commute is, to a great extent, a modern phenomenon, but mobility constraints have been governing the kind of work that women undertake for a long time. Roughly half a century ago, the anthropologist Judith K. Brown observed that throughout history, women gravitated toward jobs with characteristics that made them compatible with childcare. They tended not to require rapt concentration, were relatively repetitive and easy to interpret and resume, and didn't require the woman to stray terribly far from home. In post-industrial societies, many of the requirements Brown cited for making work compatible with child rearing have become less relevant. Women work in all sorts of industries requiring focused concentration, for example. But distance from the home, which of course affects commute time, may play a larger role in employment-based gender inequality than ever, as other factors, such as gaps in education between men and women, have declined in significance. The study that seems to have kicked off much of the research on commutes was published about a decade ago. It found that in U.S. cities with longer average commute times, married women's workforce participation rates tended to be lower. A couple of years ago, researchers attempted to replicate the finding with more detailed data drawn from 272 cities across the country and found that it held up. A 10-minute increase in average commute time decreases by 4.4 percentage points the probability that married women in the area work. The effect has driven pretty much entirely by moms, rose with the number of children they had, and was bigger for those with younger children. I think it's very strong evidence that commuting is bad. Geoffrey Monseni, a co-author of the study, told me, but particularly for women. Even when commuting doesn't push moms to leave the workforce entirely, it can shape the sort of jobs they take. One recently published working paper used an unusually rich data set to document the career moves that people make before and after becoming parents. It found that before parenthood, men and women both tend to make steady progress in their career, moving to better-paying companies and to higher-paying jobs within those companies. But after the children enter the picture, moms, not dads, start shifting to jobs at lower-paying employers or to entirely different industries. For instance, moms may move out of finance into healthcare or education. Mothers seem to be trading lower pay for flexibility or other accommodations. Brendan Timpe, an economics professor at the University of Nebraska and Lincoln, and a co-author of the paper, told me. He and his colleagues found that many young moms moving to lower-paying employers were opting for jobs with part-time hours, more opportunities for remote work, and shorter commutes. These findings are not unique to the United States. A 2022 study of data from Belgium found that, as in many other countries, a substantial employment gap opens between men and women after parenthood, largely because moms are so much more likely than dads to leave jobs outside their local area. A study this year using data from Norway found that after having a child, mothers reduce their commute time considerably more than fathers do, leaving them with fewer and lower quality job opportunities. And a paper last year looking at Germany found that women's willingness to sacrifice wages for a shorter commute jumps by 130% after they have a child and does not start to decline again until the child reaches age 12. Collectively, these studies suggest that commuting is a hindrance to employment for moms regardless of their socioeconomic status, but that the manner in which they downshift their career varies. One paper published in June found that mothers without a college degree are much more likely than college-educated moms to leave the workforce on account of a long commute. Timpe's paper, meanwhile, observed that among those moms who remained in the workforce but switched to lower-paying jobs for benefits such as a shorter commute, the highest-paid workers took the largest hit. If you think about people working at, you know, Goldman Sachs, that's really where you see the biggest drops, Timpe said. And of course, some moms don't have the option of leaving the labor market. Another paper found that although commute distances widens the gender wage gap among all moms, the effect is a bit smaller among single moms who likely have no choice but to carry on working, regardless of how terrible traffic is. It's worth spelling out why commuting is such a headache for parents. For one, the longer you commute, the more child care you are likely to need and less time you get to spend with your kids. But of many of the researchers I spoke with for this article believed that the draw of a short commute has less to do with the time people might save in a typical day and more to do with their ability to reliably show up for their kids. Getting to daycare or school pickup on time is an essential part of the parenting gig. Long commutes heighten the risk of something, whether traffic or a train delay, causing a holdup. Even if a child doesn't need their parent for midday errands or emergencies every day, on any day, they might need a parent. Kids get sick, have a doctor appointment, forget their lunchbox, or have an assembly or other event that calls for parents' presence. All these activities take time, and they might be increasingly difficult to perform in a situation where just going back and forth from work requires you 45 minutes or 1 hour, Ilaria DeAngelis, an economics professor at the University of Massachusetts at Boston and co-author of the June paper, told me. And although the need to reach a child quickly may come up relatively infrequently, Timpe said, you kind of have to make a huge employment decision based on that. One parent may end up adjusting or limiting their work to ensure they can stay in proximity to their kids. And statistically speaking, it's usually the mom. The long commute phenomenon might be made less punitive for women if more men were to modify their career to stick close to the kids. But that doesn't so much solve the problem as redistribute it. If more dads were to take the hit, the commute burden would simply shift to them, rather than helping more parents, whether moms or dads, work higher pay jobs, paying jobs. One potential fix, employers could offer flexible hours or reduce the career-hampering effect of commutes by allowing more employees to work from home. Such flexibility is probably one reason that commuting is less likely to push highly educated women out of the labor market, DeAngelis says. Such women generally have a better chance of finding work that can be done remotely. For those without the ability to work from home, efforts to reduce congestion or invest in faster or more reliable public transportation, worthy goals, though much harder to attain, would almost certainly help. Yet another option would be to find ways to enable people to live closer to where they work. One recent study examining how the commute penalty is linked to the spatial distribution of jobs found something that is going to sound blindingly obvious, but that is worth teasing out. A mom's preference for a short commute penalizes her only when acting on it means sacrificing a higher wage opportunity. Consider the finance industry in which the good jobs are typically concentrated in city centers. Sitian Liu, an economics professor at Queen's University in Ontario, Canada, told me that among financial workers living in U.S. city centers, one doesn't see much of a gender gap or a commute penalty. That makes sense because if you live in the financial district, the need or desire for a short commute has little bearing on women's ability to access high-paying jobs. Only among finance workers in the suburbs does a large gender commute gap and resulting gender wage gap emerge. But things look different in other high-skill, high-paying industries, such as medicine. Balancing work and parenthood as a physician, for instance, is no easy feat, no matter one's distance from the workplace. Because hospitals and doctors' offices are more geographically distributed, however, female doctors are less likely than finance workers to be penalized for living in the suburbs, Liu explained. Those who decide to live outside the city still have access to high-paying nearby jobs. Together, these findings point to two ways to minimize the commute penalty. Make it easier for more moms to live closer to existing job hubs, perhaps by building more family-friendly housing in urban centers, or spread the jobs out. Motherhood will likely always shape women's involvement in the economy, but the commute penalty research demonstrates that moms' ability to work depends greatly on practical, often malleable aspects of how that work fits into their daily life. When mothers are in a situation where they can really reconcile their family life with their work life, DeAngelis said, they do that. The task for a society intent on reducing gender pay inequality is to create the conditions where that type of reconciliation is possible. Our second story comes from the health section. The Big Tobacco Playbook comes for your Oreos. A new lawsuit likens food companies to the tobacco industry, but it's much harder to do something about junk food than cigarettes. This is written by Nicholas Florco. Without fail, any big corporation accused of conspiring against public health will be compared to Big Tobacco. When oil companies downplayed the threat of climate change, they were allegedly following in the footsteps of cigarette manufacturers. The NFL's strategy for disputing the link between football and concussions has similarly been likened to the tobacco industry's actions. The online gambling industry has supposedly acted like Big Tobacco, as have the tech industry and the plastic industry. Earlier this month, one such comparison ended up in a lawsuit. In the first such case of its kind, San Francisco sued several of the nation's largest food companies, including Kraft Heinz, Nestle USA, and PepsiCo, alleging that They had copied the tobacco industry's playbook by deliberately engineering processed food to be irresistible and then concealing the risks. They used big tobacco tactics to research, design, and sell addictive products, David Chiu, the city attorney, said at a press conference. What is this comparison really saying? An executive focused on selling more Oreos or cans of Mountain Dew might have an interest in encouraging unhealthy dietary habits, but that is not self-evidently the same as the misdeeds of the tobacco industry, which for decades covered up the evidence that cigarettes caused cancer, while continuing to sell what's been called the most dangerous consumer product ever. I ran the analogy by several nutrition experts. Of course, food is more complicated than tobacco, Marion Nestle, an emeritus professor at New York University, told me. The risks of cigarettes are well established, but researchers still struggle to define what even counts as an ultra-processed food, let alone pinpoint the exact reason these foods prompt people to overeat. However, there are notable similarities between the two industries and the products they sell, she said. Researchers do know that ultra-processed foods, such as Coca-Cola and Pringles, are among the biggest contributors to obesity and other diet-related diseases, which are linked to an estimated 1 million deaths in the United States each year. The two industries also use similar strategies to cast doubt on the dangers of their products. Junk food companies know the harm they're doing, and they do it anyway, Robert Lustig, an emeritus professor of pediatrics at UC San Francisco, told me. Consider Coca-Cola. Roughly a decade ago, the food giant funded a think tank that reportedly attempted to shift the focus of obesity away from poor diets and instead highlight the role that exercise can play in weight management. Like big tobacco, food companies have also attempted to convince consumers that some of their unhealthy products might actually be good for them. In 2016, Coca-Cola settled a lawsuit filed by consumer advocates alleging that the company falsely advertised vitamin water as containing just vitamins and water. As part of the settlement, the company agreed to change its marketing and note on its bottles that the drink contains sweeteners. For decades, big tobacco and big food were in many cases one and the same. In 1985, the tobacco giant R.J. Reynolds bought Nabisco. 3 years later, Philip Morris, the company responsible for the Marlboro Man, acquired Kraft Foods. Philip Morris later purchased Nabisco and absorbed it into Kraft, before relinquishing control of the company in 2007. It was during this time period that junk food became so irresistible. A recent study found that from 1988 to 2001, foods developed by tobacco-owned companies versus other companies were far more likely to be hyperpalatable, meaning they contained large quantities of carbs, fat, and salt. Food companies deny comparisons to big tobacco. A spokesperson for the Consumer Brands Association, a lobbying group that represents packaged food companies, told me that attempting to classify foods as unhealthy simply because they are processed, or demonizing food by ignoring its full nutrient content, misleads consumers and exacerbates health disparities. I reached out to the 11 food companies named in the San Francisco lawsuit and heard back from only Coca-Cola. A company spokesperson told me in an email that comparisons between big tobacco and big food are flawed, and pointed out that Coca-Cola also sells a variety of low and no sugar options. In response to the claims that Coca-Cola has downplayed the effects of its products on obesity, the spokesperson said that the company has since strengthened its transparency standards and allows the researchers it funds to control the design, data, and publication to ensure objectivity. Comparing Big Food and Big Tobacco is certainly an evocative rhetorical device. It underscores the severity of America's obesity problem, and it points out the way food is manufactured can itself be part of the problem. Villainizing food companies has become a popular message, one that has galvanized Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his Make America Healthy Again movement. Food giants are literally poisoning our children systematically for profit, Kennedy said last year. As Health and Human Services Secretary, Kennedy has cracked down on ultra-processed food, pushing states to ban the purchase of soda with food stamps and pressurizing companies to phase out synthetic food dyes. And yet Americans still love big food. Hershey's, Heinz ketchup, and M&M's are among America's most trusted brands, according to a recent Morning Consult report. As a result, drastic measures that would improve diet-related disease in this country, the kinds that were used against the tobacco industry, are still quite unpopular. Cigarette taxes have proved to reduce smoking rates, but attempts to levy even a small tax on soda have failed in cities across the country. Other ideas, such as creating a minimum age to buy junk food, aren't even discussed by lawmakers. I asked Chu, the San Francisco city attorney, if he would support such a policy, and he punted. My office is employing our tools as we can to address the crisis in front of us, he told me, but we welcome other actors and stakeholders to be involved. In some ways, comparing big food to big tobacco undersells just how difficult it will be to remedy the problems with the American diet. To push Americans away from cigarettes, public health advocates had a simple message: don't smoke. There's no equivalent slogan for food. Although roughly 40% of American adults smoked in the 1960s, when cigarettes were at their most popular, ultra-processed foods are everywhere in 2025. They make up more than 50% of what adults eat at home. They're not just Kit Kat bars and Twinkies, but also Campbell's soup, Wonder Bread, and Hot Pockets. The world can live without cigarettes, but the same cannot be said of food. Our next article is also written by Nicholas Florco. The risk of Trump's marijuana order. For more than 50 years, America's official position on marijuana has been seen as nonsensical. By classifying pot as a Schedule I drug, the federal government has lumped it with heroin and LSD as substances with no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. In 1972, 2 years after marijuana use was relegated to the most restrictive category of drugs in America, a government report found that weed's actual impact on society does not justify a social policy designed to seek out and firmly punish those who use it. Even with the federal classification, states have been experimenting with marijuana legalization for nearly three decades. These laws have led to fewer marijuana-related arrests without dramatic increases in crime. They haven't substantially spiked the rate of illicit adolescent cannabis use. Although fully legalizing recreational marijuana remains controversial, it's clear that smoking a joint from your local dispensary is not the same as using heroin. Now America's marijuana policies are getting a bit more in line with the actual science. Today, Donald Trump signed an executive order directing the government to move the drug to Schedule 3, a classification for substances with moderate to low potential for physical and psychological dependence. As the president emphasized in the Oval Office, the action doesn't legalize marijuana in any way, shape, or form. Selling marijuana without a prescription will still be a federal crime, just as trafficking anabolic steroids is illegal. The biggest impact from today's action will likely be on medical research. Marijuana studies have been stymied because researchers who want to experiment with Schedule I drugs need to be closely vetted by the federal government. During the signing ceremony for the executive order, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. argued that the new classification will let scientists better understand the drug. That's the hope of Ryan Vandry, a cannabis researcher at Johns Hopkins University. Vandry's lab was cleared to do cannabis research while marijuana was still in Schedule 1, but he hopes that this loosening of restrictions will open up a huge number of possibilities for us to both get at the health benefits and health risks of cannabis. At the same time, by rescheduling the drug, the government runs the risk of signaling that marijuana is no big deal. We need to be very clear in our messaging, especially to young people, that rescheduling pot does not mean cannabis is harmless. Scott Hedlin, professor at Harvard Medical School and a pediatrician who treats adolescent addiction, told me, "The government needs to figure out a way to tell Americans that even though marijuana is not as dangerous as heroin, it's still an addictive drug." When talking about the risks of marijuana, you can easily come off as a scold. Roughly 50% of Americans have tried the drug, and according to a 2024 study, the number of people using cannabis daily or near daily now eclipses the number who drink alcohol at a similar frequency. Even so, the risks of marijuana are real. It doesn't help that marijuana isn't the same as it was back when it was first scheduled back in 1970. The drug has become significantly stronger over the past several decades. The average joint in the 70s contained about 2% THC, the main psychoactive component of marijuana. In 2025, dispensaries regularly stock joints that have more than 35% THC. Studies have shown that use of higher concentration marijuana is associated with serious mental health outcomes, such as psychosis. Vandry said he hopes rescheduling will help researchers better interrogate the very strong correlation between heavy marijuana use and psychosis. None of this is to say that marijuana should stay a Schedule 1 drug, as it has for decades. In spite of this classification, millions of Americans have continued to use it. The government is now finally backing away from a misguided position about the risks of pot, but it still has to contend with the drug's complications. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.